Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week here on Premier Christian Radio on Saturdays at 2:30. And of course, people listen around the world as well as here on the radio in the UK via the podcast. And you can find the details for that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and a vast array of past programmes. Later on today on Premier between 4 and 5, the profile is here, singer-songwriter Dave Bilbrough is in the hot seat. But before all that, we've got a fascinating program for you today. Let me introduce you to my guests.
You're unbelievable.
Well, it's round two today as Andy Bannister joins me again to talk about his new book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. Andy is the Canadian director for RZIM. He's not Canadian himself, he's a Brit, and he's back in his home country to do a couple of interviews and discussions on this book that he's recently written. And we're asking today, among other things, can atheists have meaning without God? And to help us look through that and other questions, Michael Roos joins us. Michael, no stranger to this programme either. Always fun to have him on the programme, and I think he'll appreciate some of the humour that Andy brings in the book as well. Michael, an atheist, a philosopher of science at Florida State University, author of numerous books, and most lately, Atheism, What Everyone Needs to Know. So a very warm welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for having me again.
You're very welcome, Michael. Thanks for coming on again. Perhaps this time I'll come to you as we introduced Andy in the last programme, Michael. But just briefly, you've sort of been an atheist a fair while, would it be fair to say?
Yes, I was born, I was born in 1940, and my father was a conscientious objector. And after the war, he and my mother joined the Religious Society of Friends, the Quakers. So I grew up as a Quaker and went to a Quaker school in York. And then I guess around 20 or so, I lost my faith. It's easiest thing is to say I read David Hume, and that happened like that. But I don't really think it was that. I think it was just rather like stamp collecting. It was one of those things I did as a kid. And in my 20s, it no longer was that meaningful.
Right.
I've just turned 75 now. I honestly thought that by 70 I'd be back on side, as it were.
Well, look, it's not too late, Michael.
It's never too late.
Find that that's not true.
Well, look, we'll do what we can to correct that anomaly, Michael. But today on the programme, we're going to talk about the some of the arguments that exist out there, in particularly among the so-called new atheists against religion. You've been noted, Michael, it has to be said, as a bit of a thorn in the side, actually, of many of the new atheists. Although you are an atheist and you have written a book about atheism, you don't, it appears, approve of all that has gone in the name of atheism in the last several years as regards some of the most popular writers, do you?
No, I guess not. I mean, look, I live in the American South, so you don't have to tell me about how awful religion, including Christianity, can be. So I know that only too well, both sort of intellectually and socially. But, you know, if you grow up as a Quaker, it's hard to hate Christianity, you know, as much as Richard Dawkins does. And so, consequently, I feel, you know, in many respects, a great bond, not just of affection, but almost intellectual similarity, can I put it that way, with a lot of Christians, including, you know, really quite conservative theological Christians.
Well, that's interesting to hear. Now, what we're going to be looking at initially in today's programme, before talking about meaning and God and atheism, is hopefully just a few of these arguments that you spell out in the book. And just to come back to this again, Andy, from last week, it's a very humorous approach that you adopt in the book, makes it very readable, in my opinion. But you have all these slightly strange, absurd titles to the chapters with a footnote after each. So the aardvark in the artichokes, or why not all gods are the same. The Santa delusion, or why faith in God does not mean you're insane. And aim for that haystack when psychological arguments against religion fail. Now, each of these is, in a sense, tackling what you've seen come up as a typical argument against faith, belief, God. So do you want to just guide us through some of those that I've mentioned there, and we'll see what Michael has to say in response?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I think one of the interesting things, just to sort of segue off what Michael said there, I mean, I've always appreciated, Michael, your spirit of generosity and the sort of readings of your works that I've done. And in a sense, when I grew up here in the UK, that was my experience. Most of the atheist friends I had, there was a sort of generous, you know, sort of agreement that there are ways to have these conversations, get in the pub, have a pint of beer, do it in a way that's respectful. Then I moved to North America just little after the Dawkins phenomena had taken off, and began encountering this sort of more angry, vitriolic atheism, and then often backed up with tremendously bad arguments. But when you sort of gently tried to point out they were bad arguments, you didn't get a kind of, oh, let's talk about that. You got all kinds of things thrown at you, and that sort of pulled me up short. And then as I thought and reflected on that, there was a sense of how can we engage in that? Because I think a lot of people that I meet, be they atheist or Christian or all faiths or none, look at, I think, what's gone in the popular press, probably media rather, with this sort of great philosophical howitzers fired from either side of the battlefields at each other. You know, Dawkins lobs off a tweet, and then, you know, Joel Osteen says something, or, you know, and to go, how can we navigate it? And so the book really came out of a sense of how can we engage in this in a fun kind of way, as a Christian philosopher, unapologetically as one, but in a way that's a bit more fun, perhaps a bit more generous, and that people will laugh as they go. And so that was the idea behind the chapter titles.
You say at the very outset of the book, if you come to this book as an atheist, my hope is simply that you will at least commit to being a thought-through atheist, perhaps a doubter rather than a sceptic, someone who's willing to think deeply and well. Now, most atheists, certainly that I encounter, of whatever variety, wear that as a badge of pride. I'm a thinker. You know, I think about these things. You're suggesting that
I think sometimes it doesn't. I mean, it's interesting that wear it as a badge of pride. I sometimes tease, because being British, we like to be a little bit iconoclastic, and that kind of works quite well in North America, I find, is that, when someone says to me, I'm a free thinker, I sometimes like to look at them with a twinkle in my eye and say, I'm a great believer that you get what you pay for, which sometimes gets a reaction. But I think the danger is, and Christians are not immune from this. I mean, I work in Toronto, but I do a lot of work in the States as well. So, you know, when Michael described, you know, some of your experiences there with the South, I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, you have my sympathy, because I can appreciate what you've perhaps encountered. And it's not a good representation sometimes of what Christianity really is. But when you believe something deeply, either as an atheist or a Christian, sometimes there can be a tendency to grab hold of the first thing you find lying around and wave it around. And I think Dawkins, I think, and the other new atheists have done a wonderful job of coming out with soundbites. I mean, he's a wonderful writer of soundbites, maybe not his Twitter feed quite so much, but other places. And I think sometimes it's easy, you know, for an impassioned young atheist, like many of the students I meet on university campuses, to go, oh, that was a phenomenal, that was so clever, that line. But of course, as philosophers, we're taught to ask questions. And so the book is really an attempt to sort of poke at some of those and say, hang on just a moment.
Perhaps, and you can, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Michael, one of the chapters, the Santa delusion, perhaps no prizes for what you might be referencing there, or as you subtitle it, why faith in God does not mean you're insane. You talk about the fact that a lot of atheists do kind of harp on about this idea that belief in God is equivalent to belief in Santa Claus or Tooth Fairy. In fact, you quote Dawkins here, Father Christmas and the Tooth Fairy are part of the charm of childhood. So is God. Some of us grow out of all three. So what's your response when you hear fellow atheists using that kind of an argument against God yourself, Michael?
Well, first of all, well, I think that what I want to say, and I've written about this fairly extensively, is I think there are certain questions which science just simply doesn't answer. Why is there something rather than nothing? Now, you know, philosophers have argued this one moment. Wittgenstein says it's not a meaningful question. I think it's a very meaningful question. So the way I look at it is I don't think God is like Santa Claus. I think God is a serious answer to a serious question. You know, why is there something rather than nothing? Well, because of Santa Claus. I mean, that's not a serious answer. Whereas I think, let's say, a traditional Catholic response that, you know, God is a necessary being in some sense like that, you know, St. Augustine's position or something like that, I think is a serious answer to a serious question. I don't think it works. I mean, I think that there are problems with notions of necessary existence and those sort of things. But you know, the way I look at it is that's another matter. That's something that we talk about like grown-ups. I mean, it's rather like me arguing, let's say, with somebody who's, let's say, a conservative. Put it in the English context. I can say to them, I think you're wrong about this, but I think what you're offering is a serious answer to serious questions about how to run a society. Now, let's talk about them. Whereas I think somebody who says, oh, well, let's just, you know, abolish all government, you know, an extreme libertarian. I mean, I think that's a Santa Claus argument.
Right. Yes, indeed. I mean, there is also this... I think, again, something you might see quite frequently, and I don't know if you run into it, but the subject of another chapter in this book, Michael, Aim for That Haystack, or Why Psychological Arguments Against Religion Fail. So these are the sort that are related, I think, which is essentially you believe in God because you want there to be something nicer out there, or because you were conditioned to do so by your parents, and so on. What do you make of those arguments? Is there anything in it, the kind of the psychological arguments for why people have a belief in God?
Well, I mean, I can see the attraction of those, obviously. I mean, you know, as I said, I honestly thought that at the age of 70, I'd be coming on board myself because I'd have fairly heavy-duty psychological reasons for doing that. I don't take psychological reasons as such to be bad things. I mean, I think you've got to try to back them up. I mean, just having a psychological reason isn't good enough. I think, though, that could motivate you to look for, either empirical or logical or philosophical reasons. So I don't take the psychology to be in itself a negation. If it's just psychology, or sometimes, you know, you could say, well, I can see your situation and the psychology that it makes me, you know, think it's highly improbable that what you believe is in fact true. I mean, I think all of those things. But the other thing I'd want to say is one of the things I think that non-believers should do is to a certain extent fight psychology with psychology. If somebody's got, let's say, a desperate urge to believe in God, I think, you know, for psychological reasons, I think one of the things you try to do, or you ought to do if you don't believe, is say, well, why don't I have these psychological reasons? What are my psychological reasons? What is it that I, as a non-believer, I'm just turned 75 a couple of weeks ago, why is it that I, as a non-believer, don't feel that I've got to, you know, have the God hypothesis? What is it? And I think if you can... So in other words, I don't take psychology to be irrelevant.
No.
But I do think, to a certain extent, what you should do is fight psychology, if you like, with psychology, rather than just flip answers or, well, grow up, or, you know, have faith in humanity or something like that.
It cuts both ways in that sense, that we all need to ask.
I mean, I think so much of this humanism stuff, you know, the trouble is, it's just not going to turn people on.
Look, let's get a little bit from you before we jump into the meat of the rest of the programme. You in this chapter on the argument that religion is just a facet of people's psychological beliefs and so on, you quote actually former Muslim Alam Shaha, who's been on the programme before, author of the Young Atheist Handbook, who I think, encapsulates to extent the way I think a lot of people do see this. Death gives birth to gods. Without death, there would be fewer gods, if any. Inventing a god is a coping strategy that has been adopted by people since prehistoric times, and it is understandable. So in that sense, he says, you know, yes, we can kind of, we got to the point where we understand why people believe. Now we can move beyond that in that sense. So what's your answer to the person who says that, Andy?
I think it's interesting because I interact with a Lom a little bit later on in the book. I think the problem with that, I love Michael's line there about fight psychology with psychology, is I think appeals to psychology, they can sometimes be helpful, because I mean there are certainly things about the human condition and the way we tick that psychology can unlock. The problem is it becomes a very lazy catch-all. You know, why do I like cricket? Well, let's explain that psychologically. Why did I marry the woman that I did? Well, let's explain that psychologically. And actually, you're explaining nothing is one of the problems. I think as well, of course, I think the other problem with appealing to psychology in the way that Alom does to try and explain religion, of course, very often, and I make this point a number of times in the book, these bad arguments come pinging back on the atheist who's making them, because they equally work for atheism. You know, I could say to Alon, well, why is it you don't believe in God? Maybe it's because you want to live a life with no ultimate judge, where you can do entirely what you want, live your life with no ultimate consequences, and therefore you've written God out. And a couple of pages on in the book, I quote Thomas Nagel, another very well-known philosopher, and I think who is very honest about that. He says, I want atheism to be true. I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right. It's that I hope there isn't a God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. And that's fascinating. If we were going to talk psychology to go, there's psychology. Why not? What is it? Where's the passion?
I don't think you adopt Nagel's point of view in that sense, Michael. I think I've heard you say, at least, think that you'd be perfectly happy if there was a God.
I don't have a take on, you know, I certainly don't want there not to be a God. I don't think there is a God, or at least I don't think there's a God in the Judeo-Christian sense. Obviously, I start from there. I think, Andy, speaking, I presume, as an older man, maybe when you get to my age, the psychology will kick in a little bit more than you're suggesting that it does or that it should do.
A belated happy birthday to you.
You know, I really do feel that at 75, if I'm going to live the rest of my life as a happy, fulfilled human being, then at least I want some sort of answer to my life to make some sort of meaning of it. And it's tremendously important for me to have some kind of psychology, if you like, to explain to me. I mean, if there's no God and I'm sort of like Nietzsche or something, I'm going to cut my bloody throat. I mean, I'm going to be so miserable because I want there to be a God. Now, I honestly don't quite understand what it means to say I don't want there to be a God, unless, of course, I like to joke, God is like my late head master. And if God is like my late head master, then I'm right with Nagel. I don't want there to be a God either.
Well, it's interesting, Michael, because you say that, because of course the other one I quote in the book, who I think is fascinating on this, of course, is Aldous Huxley, who, I won't read the whole quote, but comes up with this amazing line kind of written back in the 1940s, where he was very honest that he wanted to live experiment sexually in a completely unfettered way. And he'd worked out, along with many of his student contemporaries, that the thing stopping him doing that was religion, and so therefore you deny religion. Can I ask you a quick question, Michael? If you woke up tomorrow morning and, I don't know, you read some new argument or some new sort of thing occurred to you, and you found yourself concluding there was a God, what would follow next? What do you think would follow if you recognised, you know what, actually, gosh, God exists? What would be the next thing that would happen?
Well, I that's a very good question, and I'm not quite sure what would happen. I mean, would I feel, for instance, a need to go to church? I'm not sure that I would. Perhaps I would. It's been so long since I've gone to church, I don't really feel that psychological need. I'm honestly not quite sure what would happen. Would I'd start to feel... If I believed that God was a kind of, Presbyterian, as I say, or something like that, probably I'd be, pretty damn scared, because and I'd be looking back on the things that I did or I didn't do, and I'd probably be, given my nature, I'd probably be thinking of all the reasons why God should dislike me rather than any reasons why God should save me. So perhaps there is something to Nagel that, you know, I honestly don't have
intrigued.
A thing about God. If God exists, you know, then I'll face up to that afterwards. But I can't, honestly don't spend my days, as it were, praying that God doesn't exist, because if he does exist, you know, in 10 years' time, it's going to be pretty hot for me, literally and metaphorically.
The reason I ask it, of course, is not to be flippant, because I think sometimes, I only know you through your writings, so I don't think I would pin this one on you from what I've read, but I have encountered it in other atheist thinkers. You know, I think there's a sense of, among some atheists I've read, to sort of see God as, you know, it's almost like an intellectual chess game that, you know, oh yes, if God exists, that's one more interesting thing I need to incorporate into my intellectual furniture. You know, I've lost that particular game of intellectual chess, but I always find it interesting to then reflect that, you know, the Bible, and certainly the New Testament, is, I think, very clear that God isn't particularly interested in our belief in him. You know, as the Book of James says,
yes,
you know, Satan believes in God and
so.
Trembles. The question is not so much a belief claim, so much as a trust claim.
Sure.
But that's maybe something for another time.
So long since I believed in God that I don't spend an awful lot of time wrestling with that one. I spend far more time wrestling with what is the meaning of my existence to me right here and now. And you know, I've mentioned being 75. I've just completed being a college professor for 50 years.
Mm.
And I have to say, without being smug or anything like that, I hadn't realized how tremendously important that was. I went down to America from Canada so I'd avoid early, you know, compulsory retirement. And I've done it for 50 years. And I honestly find that, you know, I'm at peace with myself because of that. Now, if God turns up and God says, well, that's not good enough, I don't know, God, I'm sorry. You know, I did my best.
Yeah. Well, this brings us neatly into the meat of what I wanted to discuss today anyway. So just before we kind of launch into that, whether atheists can have meaning without God, and we'll get more from you on that in a moment, Michael. Just to say that for anyone listening who would like to give their thoughts on today's programme, perhaps something that's already been said, be interested in getting your emails today. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the address to send them to. I'll happily be reading out some of your thoughts towards the end of today's programme as well, in response to recent programmes. But do get your thoughts into me about today's show. Don't forget that Andy's book available from all good Christian bookshops, I'm sure, but online and everywhere else. And of course, Michael Roos's book, Atheism, What Everyone Needs to Know. Going to make sure there are links to both books from today's programme. And you can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And go there as well for more links on how to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and to interact with today's programme by leaving comments underneath the latest edition of the programme. So we're asking today on the programme, can atheists have meaning without God?
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yes, so it's an interesting one, and one that we've already started to broach there. And Michael, you were saying that essentially you feel 75 years old, looking back on your life, you've made a good thing of it. It had value. It's at peace with yourself was the phrase you used. You say, though, you have always, this has been the prime question you've wrestled with as an atheist, is what do I make of meaning and so on. I mean, in Andy's book, this is his theme essentially in chapter 9, whether life, we can have meaning without God. How about I start with the rather bizarre story you start with in that one, Andy, just to set this up here. You imagine having a dream in which you visit a colony of penguins on an ice floe, and one of these penguins starts talking to you, and what they say is, having voiced your opinion that, oh, being a penguin, there can't be much point to it because you just sit on a nice floe in guano waiting for the next fish. And the penguin says, no, actually, I'm a very happy penguin because I've made meaning for myself. Thank you very much. In fact, I'll try and read the exact thing because it is fun the way you put it. So let me. This is in the chapter titled The Peculiar Case of the Postmodern Penguin. You say, here we go. Ah, you're too small-minded, said the penguin. That's your problem. More imagination needed. Just because I'm stuck on an ice floe doesn't prevent me from inventing a meaning for my life. Thank you very much. I can transcend ice and guano. I can soar above the gnawing monotony of existence. I can waddle free of existential restraints. I can. What else my fat little friend could do, I'm afraid I can't tell you, because at that point, the waters in front of us ripped violently apart, and the largest sea lion I'd ever seen leapt from the deep, opened its massive jaw, and swallowed the penguin whole, feathers, philosophy, and all. Then, pausing only to wink at me, it plunged back beneath the icy waves. A tattered tea cosy floated sadly on the briny surf. Bummer when that happens, said a passing seagull. I looked up in surprise. You can talk too. Lay off the Rockfort next time. That's my advice. So there you go. I mean, what was all this to illustrate the point of, Andy? And then we'll come back to Mike.
Yeah. So I think what I was trying to do in that kind of fun little way, you read it so well, Justin.
You can commission me for the talking version.
Was that sense that I think I sort of go on to unpack in the chapter that if atheism is true, if there is no God, if this reality is all that there is, and then one day, you know, I will die, one day my children will die, one day the human race becomes extinct, one day the sun expands, swallows the earth, one day the universe comes to an end, empty and dark and cold and alone, a bit like Saskatchewan, I always say to my Canadian friends, then really it doesn't matter what you do now. You can come up, you can invent all the meaning you like the penguin in that story. You can stand there and go, yes, I have meaning because, you know, I've helped save the whales. Yes, I have meaning because I've been a college professor for 50 years. All of these things. But ultimately, you're just shouting into the wind.
Whistling in the wind.
Whistling in the wind is really all you're doing. And as, you know, Michael will be aware, there's a whole strand, I think, of atheist writing, particularly an older generation, but there's a newer generation as well, who would say, you know, that's right. An atheist simply, you know, have to live with that. I quote Lawrence Krauss in the book Nietzsche and others, Bertrand Russell, for example. But interesting, I mean, Nietzsche's an interesting contradiction because on the one hand, he says things quite bleakly. On the other hand, he said, you know, he who has a why to live for can cope with almost any how.
Yet, at the same time, there's also a certain number of atheists who want to push against that sort of rather bleak outlook, I suppose, and say, no, I can have my meaning. I can invent my meaning, and I'm very happy with that. Thank you very much.
Exactly, and that's the usual response when I use this with atheist friends. Well, I can invent my own meaning, whatever it is. But I think a number of problems happen. Number one, of course, is the universe simply doesn't care. I mean, if I stand up and say, you know, my meaning in life is to do X, the universe may turn around and go, actually, you know, I'm sorry, you're about to get squashed under a passing asteroid. You know, your meaning means nothing to me. Mm. Secondly, I think you hit the subjective problem of saying, you know, I decide that my meaning in life is to save as many cute little baby seals as possible. And you, Justin, decide that your meaning in life is to club as many of the furry little critters to death as possible, make, you know, gloves out of their pelts, sell them on eBay and become very rich. We have two very, very conflicting meanings.
I love the way you put that in the chapter where you imagine a real green environmentalist and the most sort of carbon footprint chugger that you could imagine. Say you couldn't find two more different approaches to life if you locked Jeremy Clarkson and Al Gore in a broom cupboard. But you're saying there's many different interpretations
that's the
meaning of what that
exactly
brings.
And what happens when they clash. And then I think thirdly, I think it's a misuse of the word meaning. And again, analogy I use in the book, you know, if you or I are sitting there in the pub and you turn to me and say, I've just read Richard Dawkins' new book, or, you know, Michael Ruse's new book, I've just read Richard Dawkins' new book, you know what, I've concluded the God delusion is all about cookery. I've concluded it's about cookery, and I'm going to use it to just bake the best cakes possible. And I say, no, Justin, I think I've read The God Delusion, and it's about taxidermy. And the meaning that I've read into it is all about how to stuff animals with sand. And we start arguing and fighting, and it gets quite, you know, rambustious. And then in through the door of the pub, who should walk but Richard Dawkins himself? And he looks at you and I and say, what are you two jokers arguing about? And we tell him, and he goes, that's ridiculous. That's not the meaning in the book. Let me solve the problem for you. I can tell you what the meaning is. I'm the author. Now, I think most of us would say he has a point, because postmodern literary criticism aside, there is such a thing as authorial intent. If there isn't, and what we think of as the God delusion was just caused by a hand grenade being thrown into the Scrabble factory and the letter tiles falling in such a way to spell that text, then I guess, you know, maybe taxidermy is a valid meaning. Maybe French cuisine is a valid meaning.
Look, we're going to come back. We've run out of time on this first part so that Michael can respond in just a moment's time. We're asking, can atheists have meaning without God? And Andy Bannister says he doesn't think they can, really. We'll find out what our atheist guest Michael Ruse has to say in response in the next section of today's programme, Unbelievable, the place where every Saturday we aim to get you thinking.
Premier Christianity for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Jesus had completed his earthly ministry by the relatively young age of 33. In the latest edition of the magazine, we profile 33, 33 and unders, following in his footsteps by doing fresh things for God in their youth. We also meet TV preacher Joyce Meyer to talk passion and prosperity. Plus, be inspired by the testimonies of ex-convict James and ex-drug addict Susie. All that and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Hello, welcome back to the programme. Second part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And don't forget, if you want to get in touch with anything you hear on today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is one way to do it. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback later on. We've had a lot of feedback to our Summer of Scripture, where various Bible scholars, believing and non-believing, joined me to debate the reliability of Scripture, the resurrection, and much more. We've also got responses to a show of a couple of weeks ago when Zachary Arden, a young Christian biologist, interacted with Peter Atkins, a long-standing atheist scientist. So we'll look forward to some of that a little bit later on in the programme. Also going to be telling you about a couple of important events coming up shortly as well. But today on the programme, we've got the second of two discussions on the book The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. It's by Andy Bannister. He's my Christian guest on the show today. And he's in discussion with Michael Roos, who is, of course, an atheist philosopher. And they're talking about whether we can have meaning without God. Can an atheist have meaning? So coming back to you then, Michael, ultimately, can you, as an atheist, have, if you like, ultimate meaning?
Well, obviously, if you're going to define meaning in some sort of, what shall I say, eschatological sense, then clearly you can't have meaning in the penguin sense, let's put it that way, because almost by definition, you're saying the only way I can give meaning to life and to, you know, the tragedies that happen to, say, somebody is born a thalidomide child or something like that, the only way I can give meaning to this is by assuming that, you know, this life is not the only one and that, you know, it will all become clear or present in the, you know, eternity or when we come face to face with God. Then obviously I agree with you. Somebody like myself obviously cannot have meaning with a capital M in that sort of way. So I agree there. Now the question is, where do you go from there? Is it the case then, the only flip side is to take almost, you know, a grim Nietzschean type of existentialism sort of position? Oh my God, God doesn't exist. I'm miserable. Life is meaningless. I'm doomed. It is all barren. And a little bit like, one of those paintings from the early 19th century out of Germany where all you see are icebergs and nothing else. Is that the only alternative? And what I'm trying to say is I don't think it is. And I'm not unique in this. I mean, you look at, say, somebody like Thomas Henry Huxley, for instance, or many others. And I don't want to talk to Richard Dawkins or whatever, but for many others who say, no, I find that at a certain important level, I can get over the God issue. Whether or not God exists isn't what either motivates me or what I live with. What I live with is myself, with my family, with my, you know, the world. And do I have a sense of self-worth in some sort of sense? I recognize that many people cannot have or won't have, or somebody who gets killed in a car accident at 15 won't have the chance of this. But, you know, I recognize that, but you know, these things happen. The question is, can somebody like you or me find a worth, if you like, if you don't want to use the word meaning, use some other word, a sense of self-worth without God and without the necessity of putting it all in some ultimate metaphysical position? Now, as I say, I honestly thought at 20 that probably I couldn't. What I find, and I'm quite serious about this, to my astonishment, I find that in my 70s, yes, indeed, this is so. In many respects, I find that I'm happier within myself. I could imagine a Christian saying, well, you're just deluding yourself. Well, maybe so. But I find that I can find meaning. Of course, I'm a philosopher. I've spent a lot of time thinking about the God question. So it's not a question of, I'm just ignoring the God question or I'm just not going to go there. I've been there. My God, I've spent 50-odd years of my life going there and looking at it. The question is, I find that I cannot find an answer there. And so now the question is, can I find a sense of self-worth? I'm prepared to use the word meaning, but if you don't like to use the word meaning, a sense of self-worth, a self-contentment, and I don't mean complacency, I really don't mean complacency, but a sense that of dignity, if you like, that I could look, I mean, my mother died when I was 13. Can I now look at my mother in the face and say, Mum, I really think I have done, I have returned what you gave to me. And I feel, honestly, for the first time in my life, I could look my mother in the face and say, you gave me so much. I think I have, here's a biblical one. And I take it very seriously. I have used my talents wisely.
Yes,
I
yes.
have not buried them in the ground. And that, for me, is all important.
Okay, really interesting. Okay, Andy.
I think a couple of things there that intrigue me, Michael. I mean, one is, I mean, your sense of duty is very interesting. Duty to your mother, and I think obviously be very careful here, not getting the phones ringing from older listeners. But you grew up in that generation, I think, where perhaps the whole sense of duty was a very important thing built into you. Which I think my generation, I'm 42, is not perhaps as strong as it might have been. But interesting listening to that, of course. What you would say to somebody who looks at you and goes, well, I'm glad that you found meaning there, Michael. That's great. Actually, quite frankly, I've spent most of my life just drinking away the family inheritance and completely peeing all over my family's legacy. But I don't care. I'm happy, quite frankly. I'm completely happy. I'm not sure whether that gives what we say to that, whether it just means we're left with a position saying, well, if you're happy, that's great. If I'm happy, that's great. But we can't get further than that. But I'm interested that you use the term self-worth. Very, very interested that you did that. Because years ago, my first job before I went down the philosophy route was working in psychiatry. I worked for a large London teaching hospital, not practicing medicine, working on the administration side. But most of my best friends were psychiatrists, which probably explains a lot about why I'm slightly odd. And I remember one of the questions that used to occur to me that I would occasionally, in my more mischievous moments, put to psychiatrist friends or psychologist friends, is to say, well, what do you do as a counsellor or as a therapist, if there's you're faced with a patient sitting on your couch, and they say, "Doctor, I'm struggling with self-worth, I'm struggling with self-image," and you start asking questions of that patient, and you discover that they've got no job, they've been fired from the previous 7 jobs, their family has wife has left them, taken the kids with them, or perhaps they were teenagers and left the kids behind, they support some dead-end football club, they've got no hopes, no prospects, nothing, their life is pretty dreadful. And I said to my friends, what do you say to them as a counsellor? Because presumably you have to say, no, your life really has value. But it doesn't. I mean, objectively, that's a lie. And I guess where I'm going with that, I mean, you've had a very successful career as a professor, written many books, travelled widely, well-respected. That's great, some people would say. But what about somebody whose life hasn't, the forces of time plus chance plus natural selection haven't thrown those cards up and is sitting there going, well, actually, I'm 75, I'm, my family have left me, I'm alone. There is no meaning. I guess what's the best you can offer them, Michael? Just maybe you can find one if you look harder.
I have nothing to offer them any more than, and I'm not being flip now.
No, go ahead.
A Christian would have to offer Adolf Hitler. I take it a Christian if a Christian met Hitler, I take it that they would say, you are an evil man. Everything you've done, negates the worth of being a human being, and I have nothing to offer to you. So I fully recognize that as I say, some people die early. Some people are born in such awful situations that there's no way they can or they do pull themselves out, just as, let's be honest about it, some people are born in such awful situations that they're pretty much bound to be liars and cheats and thieves and you know, by any standard, bad people. So, at a certain level, that fits to my world picture better than the Christians, in the sense that I don't expect everything to be good or everything to work. I mean, you know, these things just happen. All I can say is I think it is possible for a person to find a sense of self-worth. And, of course, that having said that, of course, your psychiatrist friends, I mean, I take it that a lot of them would say the secret is not meeting with people at 65 whose lives are appalling, but let us see how we can work with society so they don't end up that way. What can we do to help children, help children build a sense of self-worth so they don't leave school feeling inadequate because they weren't very good at games and they had, you know, teenage acne and that sort of thing. What can we do to help everybody? So, you know, at a certain level, I'm with the Christians here in the sense that I want to say, let's help people. But I think what I'm saying is, just as the Christian would say that somebody can live a meaningful life so that, depending on the theology, at least they can say to God, I used my talents. I'm saying the same. So in many respects, my position is very parallel to a believer's. And I, if you say I've got problems, I don't think my problems, are in many respects the same that a Christian.
Yeah, because in a sense, I can see that response exactly that Michael put there, Andy, which is, well, on the Christian view of things, I don't see that the situation is any better. There are still people who are living desperate, sad, hopeless lives. Are you saying that because there is an ultimate, maybe there's life beyond the grave, that somehow is a panacea for the problems?
Saying a number of things. I mean, we could obviously have a fascinating discussion here around the whole question of the problem of evil and suffering, and whether it even makes sense to talk of evil and good if there is no God. Things simply are. But I think, you know, to stay in the whole area of psychology that we've touched on a couple of times, I mean, one of the folks that I talk about in the book, there's a fascinating psychologist, American psychologist, called Roy Boymeister. Wrote a book a few years ago called Meanings of Life. I don't think he's a theist. I mean, he doesn't give it away if he is. And in that book, he says, you know, speaking as a psychologist, there, you know, to answer the question, the meaning of life, there are actually four other questions you need to answer first. To answer that question, you need to answer the question of identity. Who am I? You need to answer the question of value. You know, do I matter? The question of purpose. Why am I here? And the question of agency. Can I make a difference? And he says, as a psychologist, those are the four questions that you need to help somebody deal with and find answers to. But the value one is interesting, because if you think about it for a moment, what the Christian worldview has to say, if it's true, is that your life does have value. Because where does value come from? Well, of course, in economic theory, value comes from what someone's prepared to pay. The reason my iPad sitting on the desk here is worth $500 or whatever I paid for it in Canada is because that's what I paid for it. Mm. I took it to a desert island, and with no Wi-Fi, no power, no cell phone reception, probably no one's going to pay anything for it.
It becomes a paperweight.
Yeah, and it becomes valueless. Yeah. So now that raises an interesting question about you and I, about human beings. You know, where does our value derive from? And the Christian answer quite simply is that you and I have an infinite worth, whether you are a happy college professor, you know, sitting enjoying an ocean view wherever Michael is, or, you know, you are in a radio studio, or if you're somebody who's down on their luck, because your value is not determined by your circumstances, your value is not determined by your earning potential, your value is not determined by the size of your social network, both your real friends and the fake friends you have on Facebook, but your value is determined by what God was prepared to pay for you in the life of Jesus Christ, his son. And so I think Christianity does have something quite unique to offer on that value
and which
question.
Has presumably, in your view, Andy, supported many people in the worst possible situations who you might expect to say, my life has and have not gone to that conclusion.
One of the things that does intrigue me is one of the real benefits of my working in a job that I do is I get to travel a lot, like I'm sure Michael does. And I think I'm always struck by the fact that I regularly get to meet people whose life circumstances are pretty horrendous. You know, people dealing with drug addiction, or, you know, trying to escape from prostitution on the streets of Delhi or whatever it is. And to go, when you meet people in those situations, people who you'd expect, certainly by, say, a Western metric, to be unhappy and miserable and all those other things, often you meet people, I think, who have a happiness and a joy there that is quite startling. And I think one of the things I found interesting as a Christian is the lessons I've learned from Christians who are in circumstances and parts of the world where perhaps they're facing poverty or persecution, yet find that happiness that in one sense shouldn't be there. And I think if you look here in the West, what's interesting is incidences of things like depression and anxiety and those kind of disorders are increasingly off the charts.
I suppose the question coming back to you here, Michael, is as an atheist then, or on an atheist worldview, is meaning at some level determined by the luck of the draw, i.e. yes, if you're lucky enough to be born into a situation where you can look back on your life and see, you know, good times, value and everything else, great.
Yes, I think that's true, but I think Andy's making a very interesting and I think worthwhile point. Is obviously meaning for me is very much in the context of a middle class Westerner, you know, who was born in 1940. And as I think Andy's point is very well taken, that were I, let us say, born in a large family in Kenya, let's say, my expectations wouldn't necessarily be the same, or where I'd find a sense of self-worth wouldn't necessarily come. I mean, I can't think of anything more boring, for instance, than spending my day looking after a flock of goats or sheep. But I could see that somebody, and I'm trying not to sound condescending now, but I could see how somebody in that kind of context could find a sense of self-worth. Now, whether or not, to what extent they're going to find a sense of self-worth if they're a drug addict prostitute on the streets of, you know, Bombay. You're not allowed to call it Bombay anymore, are you? But you know what I mean. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. But I think Andy's point is very well taken, that one can find a sense of self-worth, if you like, not necessarily in the context of a middle-class Western professor.
And in a sense, what do you make of his view that Christianity at least answers one of these points about meaning, which is that,
well, of course,
everyone has infinite value? That
I mean,
you aren't,
I've conceded that. I mean, obviously, as I said, excuse me, this is why I don't take Christianity to be a flying spaghetti monster or Father Christmas sort of answer. I think Christianity is a very serious answer to a very serious question, or series of questions. What is the meaning of it all? Why is there something rather than nothing? Whether it's an adequate answer is another matter, but that's why I personally take Christianity very seriously indeed, because I think it is a grown-up solution to a grown-up problem. Whether it's an adequate solution, whether it works, is another matter. But I certainly do, and I agree with you or Andy, that if Christianity is true, then at some level you can get a level of meaning, capital M meaning, that if it's not true, you can't get. So now the question is, where do you, and this is the point I made earlier, where do you go from here? Do you flip right over over to it? You know, I'm sure Nietzsche scholars are going to say you've got a misconception of Nietzsche, but let's say, you know, a Nietzsche sort of position of, oh my God, there is no God, you know, life is meaningless, I'm in despair. Or do you say, no, I think that there's some kind of middle way, if you like, where I can find a sense of self-worth, where, and as I say, at a certain level, yeah, I'm using Christian sort of concepts. Yeah. I mean, as I say, the parable of the talents for me is all important.
Wonder what you'd make of this passage that Andy quotes in his book. Again, it's by someone we mentioned earlier, atheist Alam Shahar, who says people seem to struggle with the notion that life is all there is. Many seem to think that if they accept that this is it, life has no meaning. A friend once compared this to saying that a cake has no meaning once you've eaten it. A cake provides you with a pleasurable experience, a focus for celebration, a memory, and even perhaps a wish. An eaten cake will give you energy. Some of its atoms may literally become part of you through the processes that are continually replacing the billions of cells in your body. Similarly, when you die, your memory and the things you did will live on for a while, but your atoms will live on for a lot longer, becoming part of the other objects in the universe. So there's this sort of analogy, it's a parable of sorts by Alam Shahar saying, you know, we invest things with meaning in the way that we do with the cake. We make the most of it while we're eating it, and then what it does is kind of lives on in some way physically in the universe. And what do you make to those kinds of attempts to kind of say there can be meaning? We sort of make our own meaning. We make this cake-like meaning in the universe we live in. What do you make of that, Michael?
Well, you know, when you say this, you remind me of a book I'm writing on evolution and literature. And I'm thinking of Hardy's great poem, Drummer Hodge, about the lad who's killed in the Boer War. And, you know, he doesn't know why he's there, but his body is going to grow into trees and things like that. Yes, I mean, I personally don't think that's a hell of a lot of meaning. Frankly, I'm against, at a certain level, I rear against that, just like I rear against humanism, because I worry that what you're trying to do then is achieve meaning with a capital M. In other words, Andy's sort of meaning, but you're trying to do it, you know, from a non-believer, an atheist's position.
You're trying to have your cake and eat it, you could say.
And I'm inclined to think that that's fallacious.
Right.
I just don't. I'm very uncomfortable with doing that. I personally, certainly, am not looking for that kind of meaning. I think that if you give up Christianity or Judaism or whatever, meaning with that capital M is no longer for you. And
okay.
People who say, oh, well, let's get it in humanism, let's get it in, you know, the UUs, Unitarian Universalist, I think are often given to this, or let's get it in some, you know, Drummer Hodge sort of way, you know, our atoms live on. Yes, they do, but it's not meaning with a capital M, and I just don't think...
But it seems like humanists are really concerned with meaning. Most of the statements I see plastered on the British Humanist Association website by their celebrity patrons are about meaning. So, and you quote one of them here, Andy, humanists agree that there is no karmic law, no grand plan, no grand planner to make the world make sense for us. Instead of discovering the meaning of life, we're faced with the job of creating meaningful lives for ourselves. Now, does Alam Shahar's meaningful cake help us down this
line? I don't think it does. And I think it's interesting. It's interesting to find that there's lots of areas that Michael and I agree on, and obviously some that we don't. But no, I'd largely agree with Michael. And I think one of the problems with there, and I confess I have some fun with Alam over several pages of the cake illustration. I mean, certainly the idea of the atoms living on, you know, the problem you have is, of course, my atoms may live on and they may become part of a food processor or part of an atom bomb. They may become part of a Nobel Prize winning scientist, or they may become part of a dictator. The atoms will just carry on doing their thing. But we've inherently brought a value judgment to that list. I think the idea that your atoms might go on to be part of the next Pol Pot would profoundly
disturb
you. None of
us quite like that, do we? No.
Which raises a number of questions. One is, I don't think there's any hope of finding meaning there. And
from
I also think it shows us a value judgment that gets smuggled in all the time. But I don't think, you see, where I disagree with Michael is, of course, I profoundly disagree with Michael, is I don't think you can simply sort of whistle in the wind and produce meaning with a small M. I mean, I think that is just whistling in the wind. I mean, one of the stories I tell in the book is the old Indian folk tale known as the Indian on the Raft, and it's quite an old story, and it tells this idea of an Indian gentleman, you know, paddling along the river, having whale of a time, and then suddenly in the distance he hears a distant roar, and the river has this sort of slightly strange cut off look in the horizon, and he realizes he's racing down the river towards a waterfall, huge waterfall, and he's going to plunge to his death. So he takes his paddle out and he tries to paddle to the left, but the current's too strong, tries to paddle to the right-hand bank, the current is too strong, tries to paddle upstream, and of course, no hope there. And then finally, realizing that there's nothing he can do, he throws the paddle into the river, lies back on the raft, puts his hand behind his head, and just enjoys the ride, because he's going to go
into oblivion.
Oblivion. And I think meaning with a small M falls into that category of going, we're going into oblivion, there's nothing we can do about it, there are some huge consequences that flow from atheism, don't look too hard, in fact best not go there,
or you'll be depressed,
or you'll be depressed, let's try not to ask those kind of questions. Don't be too honest, I mean, don't read Nietzsche, probably not a good idea, and certainly those French existentialists are probably a bit unhelpful as well. Hey, look over here, it's a kitten. And
I think that difference, you know, between that and me is I didn't set out to find it. I have found it. My answer is I'm just surprised to find that 50 years of teaching means as much to me as it does. I really truly had no idea that I would have this. It, the way you're putting it is, oh, well, you know, God doesn't exist. Where can I find meaning? Let's keep searching for something. And I want, you know, it's a gift of God that I find that I haven't had to search for the meaning. The meaning has come as part of it. And now, you know, I'm not the first to say this. I mean, if you look at Plato, Plato in the Republic says the only truly happy person is the good person. Plato doesn't say, you know, search for happiness, be good. It's an integral sort of thing. Mm. So I think, Andy, you've got to be careful. I mean, atheists are given to parodies of Christianity. I think you've got to be careful not to get into parodies of non-Christianity, if I might put it that way.
No, I think that's a helpful point. The interesting thing, though...
Oh, God, I'm sounding like a professor.
You are, aren't you? And I'm not offended at all, because I don't think that I do. I'm trying to avoid that, but I do think...
I know.
The interesting thing, though, I mean, I love the fact you use the word gratitude there, because I think, actually, the gratitude question is a really profound one, because I think, you know, somebody once said, you know, the greatest problem for many people is not they have nothing to be thankful for, but no one to be thankful to. And I think what's interesting is I agree with you. I think your teaching, 50 years teaching, is phenomenal, because I think education is a good. I think the pursuit of truth is a fantastic thing. I think training young minds, helping people become, grow into and flourish into potentially good citizens is a wonderful thing. But the value in that, for me, flows from my Christian faith. I believe there's such a thing as good. And you mentioned Plato. Plato, of course, if he was writing in English, would have spelt the good with a capital G, because he, effectively, the good plays the role of God, really, in his philosophy. If there is no God, then I think that hits some implications. It means that, you know, the pursuit of truth, be it in philosophy or biology, whatever, doesn't actually really matter. It's great that you've taught people, but equally it wouldn't have mattered if you've gone out and tortured kittens for 50 years. I, on the other hand, think what you've devoted your life to is phenomenal and has value. But the reason I can say that is because I think there's a purpose and a direction and a, you know, built into reality.
We're going to take a quick break and see what Michael has to say in response. Really interesting stuff today. And if you're interested in responding yourself, perhaps you're an atheist and you think meaning, you know, is what you make of life. And that's all there is to it. We make the best of what we're dealt in this the universe we live in. Be interested to hear from you equally if you're a Christian or believer, theist, whatever, and you'd like to have your say in this. Why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Just a very quick break and we'll be back with my guests Andy Bannister and Michael Roos as we conclude today's discussion on whether atheists can have meaning without God. Welcome back to today's programme. It's the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget that later on today, between 4 and 5, the profile is here. Dave Bilbra talks about his life and faith. He's in the hot seat between 4 and 5 today. Next week on Unbelievable, we're going to be doing something completely different, talking about China. Next week, John Lombard and David Marshall join me. They're both based out in China. One is an atheist, one is a Christian. And they're going to be debating, should China's future be atheistic or Christian, particularly when it comes to morality, secular humanism or a Christian framework for morality. So look out for that at the same time next week. Also going to be telling you during the feedback session in today's programme about a couple of events coming up. There's the second of the Unbelievable discussion groups coming up on Monday, September the 7th, and it's on some of the subjects we've touched on during our Summer of Scripture here on Unbelievable, as they ask, can we trust the Gospels? And Reboot as well, coming up towards the end of September. That's an apologetics event for young people put on by the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. So more details on that to come in a moment's time. Of course, a lot of your feedback as well. I've got a bulging mailbag from all the shows we've done over the summer, and I'll try to get to some of that as well.
One more thing I'd love to tell you about as well is that I'm going to be putting out a special programme this coming Monday, the 31st of August, at 10 p.m. on Premier Christian Radio. It's called The Rainbow Through the Rain. It's the story, actually, of my grandfather. He was a prisoner of war under the Japanese during the Second World War. And because next week marks the official anniversary of the surrender of the Japanese to the Allies, I thought it was an appropriate time to rebroadcast this programme, which I actually made 10 years ago for the 60th anniversary of VJ Day. But it's a story of how his time as a prisoner of war, especially under the grueling conditions of labouring on the Thai-Burma Railway, led to his own call to Christian ministry. So if you're interested in hearing that, it's happening, as I say, at 10 o'clock in the evening on Premier Christian Radio on Monday the 31st of August, special bank holiday programme. But you can also hear it on the podcast. I'm going to put it out on the Unbelievable podcast feed. This may be of interest to you, and if so, do make sure to download that episode. It'll appear in your podcast feed at some point next week. And I hope, whether you're a believer or non-believer, you'll find it an interesting episode, certainly a very personal one for me. So look out for that. There's also an accompanying article in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine as well. And you can actually go and read that right now on the website at premierchristianity.com. Okay, that's enough of the adverts. Let's get back into the final part of today's debate. We're talking about whether atheists can have meaning.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Michael, so just as we start to wrap up today's programme, we've heard from Andy that he isn't saying what you've done is in any sense meaningless, but he can only ascribe meaning if there is an ultimate meaning. It's like you can't get the small m meaning without the ultimate m meaning is kind of where I hear Andy saying at some level. You seem to be saying, though, throughout, Michael, I've looked for the ultimate m meaning, can't seem to find it. I'm just gonna have to settle with what I find I have found along the way, which is I'm at peace. Call it meaning, call it self-worth.
You're playing Andy's game.
Am I? I apologise. I'm not being as neutral as I should be then.
You're sliding disapproval into what seems like a nice, warm, friendly question. Yes, I have sought for meaning elsewhere. I do not find it. Am I just going to have to settle for? Well, yes, I am. But, just going to have to settle for almost sounds like I've got to go to a red brick university because I couldn't get into Oxbridge, but I recognize it's not as good as it ought to be. I don't find that my non-belief, my sense of self-worth is second class, second rate, second whatever. I find that I have, and I'm trying not to sound complacent, but I feel a real deep sense of achievement, of meaning in my sense, of self-worth, of having used my talents properly. And I honestly don't feel in any sense a sense of regret. I mean, I don't feel like Nagel that I don't want God to exist. I mean, if there's a possibility of an eternity of going to opera, I want it. But I honestly want to say that the eternity doesn't, it doesn't turn me on. It doesn't turn me off. It doesn't turn me on where I find myself at the moment. So it's not a question of only just having to have this. I find it fully meaningful in my sense.
Yeah. No. Well, absolutely. And in a sense, that is all that is required as far as you're concerned, Michael. And though you don't at all, I'm getting in any sense deny for those for whom the capital M meaning is important, then that's important for them, and all speed to you if you feel that you've found that to be an important way of finding meaning.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. As I say, that's where I've come to.
Yeah. Mm. Andy, some final thoughts as we start to close things up.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating discussion. I mean, I think I would say just a couple of things really in response to land it from my side. I mean, I think what's interesting is the way the value judgments are coming in there, because I mean, Michael, I'm very, interested that the phrase use my talents well has haunted
this discussion. But of course, that implies there's a right way and a wrong way to use talents. Now, that's not perhaps not a discussion we've got time to explore, but I just find that interesting that for someone who's not so sure about eschatological or teleological explanations, there's one built in right there. But in terms of that line about, you know, second class, I mean, please, if I've given you any sense in the language that I've spoken that I think your experience is second class to mine, then I apologise wholeheartedly. It's not my intention. But I do think, because I do think you can enjoy those meanings with a small m, but I think I'm reminded of something the C.S. Lewis once said about beauty, because it was through beauty that
I knew we'd get to see.
I know, I'm sorry.
This is decline and fall.
I know, decline and fall. But something he said about
to an end.
Something he said about beauty really just intrigues me here. That he said, you know, because it was through beauty, particularly, that I think he found his way back to the Christian faith, and was that sense of, you know, that realization that the beauty that he was pursuing wasn't generated by the work of art or the piece of music. That was the vehicle through which it came. And I've always loved the image, for me, that's been a sort of controlling metaphor for my Christian life, has been those kind of signals of transcendence within the world, as if almost where someone sort of poked a hole in an old wooden garden shed and sunlight comes in. And I think to say that, you know, if someone sits in the shed and says, I'm going to enjoy the sunbeams, but I'm not interested in finding out if there's a sun or a star out there, you know what? You can enjoy the sunbeams. They're not second class. There's not a lack of value to them. But the value they do have, the meaning they have, does come, is derivative. And I think with meaning with a small m, you know, I think it's very hard to see how that doesn't follow. And ultimately, for me, at the end of the day, my concern is not whether something makes me happy or psychologically fulfilled, all of those things. I think there's only one real reason to try and wrestle with these questions of meaning, and that's, are they true? You know, does the thing that makes me happy, is it true? And we could play the game of truth with a capital T or a small t, but I think truth lies behind all of this.
I'm going to give you the last word as we finish up today's program, Michael. Go ahead.
Well, I think that sometimes, you know, that we come to a point where we just cannot tell the truth. I mean, you know, I think at some point you just simply say there are answers that I cannot give. And I you know, you quote C.S. Lewis. Let me quote J.B.S. Haldane, who said, my suspicion is the world is not only stranger than I dream, it's stranger than I could dream. And I guess that's where I go out, is that I think ultimately we look for truth, but sometimes we just simply have to say, I cannot find it. I cannot find it. So what do I do now? Let's pick up and see if we can work from there.
We're going to draw a close to things. Michael, really lovely to have you on the programme today, and you've been a terrific sport in giving your side of things and, enjoying life at 75.
Okay, yeah.
I hope I'm as enjoyable and jovial as you are at the same age. But thank you for being on the programme today.
Okay, thanks very much indeed.
All the very best.
Thanks, Michael.
And Andy, thanks for coming back for a second time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The book's available, of course. I'll make sure that people know where to go from the website to find The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, the new book by Andy Bannister, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Find it at today's show. And also find, of course, Michael's book as well, Atheism, What Everyone Needs to Know. For the moment, it's been great having you on for the last 2 weeks and to have Michael today as well. And we're going to find out what you've been making of the last few shows as well, as we go to some of your feedback coming up next here on Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we'll be getting to some of your feedback in just a moment's time, but as I mentioned, a couple of events wanted to highlight. Coming up shortly on Monday, September the 7th, at the William the Fourth Pub, 7 Shepherdess Walk in London, it's the second meeting of the Unbelievable Discussion Skeptics and Believers group. It's put together by listeners of Unbelievable, very much happened organically, not something that I've created at all, but if you'd be interested in meeting up for another discussion, their first one apparently was packed out. It'll be between 7:30 and 9:30 on Monday, 7th of September there. The question is, can we trust the gospel?
Gospels, begin with a 10-minute introductory talk setting out some evidence for the reliability of the Gospels, and then follow on by a discussion. Search for that at the meetup.com website, and you'll be able to find out more details about it. Also, a quick mention for Reboot 2015. This is a fantastic event for young people. So if you're a church leader, a youth leader maybe, this is happening on September the 26th at Emmanuel Centre, Marsham Street in London. And it's got some great speakers from the Ocker: Vince Vitale, Amy Orr Ewing, Tracy Trinita, Canon J. John, Sharon Dirks. And it's all about answering the kinds of questions that young people are asking in their Christian walk. You can find out more at the website reboot.org.uk. Let's go to some of your feedback then. And it's been lovely to get a number of people getting in touch saying that they've just started listening to Unbelievable recently. In fact, on the younger end of the spectrum, someone who might appreciate going to that Reboot conference actually, Josh says, I'm 14 years old and a weekly listener to Unbelievable by podcast. I just listened to the show with Zachary Arden and Peter Atkins. I really enjoyed the debate, but I thought Peter Atkins did not do a good job answering the questions Zach asked him. He kept calling what Zach said nonsense, and I don't think calling Christians lazy was a very good argument. Just my thoughts. Keep putting on a great show, Justin. I just literally just received a message as well from on Facebook. Johnny Sharp says, hi Justin, love listening to your show. I podcast it every week from Australia. Such a helpful way to engage with faith and reason, and you so often cover the very topics I've been musing about. But I do have one idea for a show I don't think you've done before. I'd love to hear a debate about religion in the public square. Perhaps philosophers A.C. Grayling and Miroslav Volf would be able to do the topic justice. I've heard them both speak very eloquently and passionately from either side about whether religion is valuable to modern secular democratic societies. Volf believes we need to defend and create space for religious voices in public debates, while Grayling believes that religious voices are much too loud in places like US, UK, and even here in Australia. Whether you do get to this or not, I'll be listening in with my friends down under. Love your work. Thank you very much, Johnny. Well, I haven't had those particular guys on talking about that issue, but we did do a programme a few years ago now, Oz Guinness talking about religion in the public square with someone, I think it was from the National Secular Society. So you might want to look back in the archives for that if you're interested. Here's someone else who's discovered us recently. This is Ken, who says, discovered your show on YouTube. I'm pursuing a calling to gospel ministry, especially evangelism, and I'm passionately interested in apologetics. On my introduction, visit to your show, James White was debating Roger and Faith Forster on the nature of hell. I was most impressed and enlightened as the debaters were able to expound fully, as well as explain in depth, their quite divergent points of view. I learned very easily and a great deal. Well, that's absolutely the point, Ken, so I'm really glad it had that effect. And you go on to say some nice words about me, thank you for that, and say, I plan to tune into your show henceforth. Your personal commitment to sincere inquiry offers me much hope of gaining deep insight into vital spiritual issues. Thanks very much. That's Ontario, Canada, that you're writing from. Aaron in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, says, a good friend told me about your podcast today, and I'm glad he did. I enjoyed listening to my first episode and look forward to many more interesting topics. For my first episode, I listened to the conversation you had with Dr. Moeller and Chris Date regarding the traditional view of hell, as well as the forthcoming conditionalist or annihilationist view. I thought the podcast was very balanced and both participants presented their views very well. Another view that was mentioned was that of the Christian Universalist view. I'd be very excited to hear this view presented and debated on Unbelievable. I'm sure someone like Robin Parry, Brad Jerzyk, or Peter Hyatt would be delighted to take part. I particularly like what Robin Parry, author of The Evangelical Universalist, has to say, as well as the graciousness with which he presents his views. Well, Aaron, as you I literally only just discovered the podcast on the day you sent this email, you may not have had a chance to look through the archive. We have done the Universalism debate as well a number of times, and in fact with Robin Parry, who you mentioned there. I think you have to go back to 2009 when we had him on, as when he kind of revealed his identity as the author of The Evangelical Universalist. But perhaps most famously, we sort of covered it as well when we had that debate with Rob Bell in 2011 and Adrian Warnock, which was probably one of the most downloaded programs ever on Unbelievable after the publication of Love Wins by Rob Bell. But glad you found it, and enjoy rifling through the back catalogue. Let's go to some of your emails then. We're still getting lots of emails about our Summer of Scripture. We had effectively two different kinds of debates going on. Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew were debating the reliability of Scripture and whether coincidences between the Gospels give them the ring of truth. And of course, that fantastic programme on the minimal facts for the resurrection between Gary Habermas and James Crossley and their New Testament Q&A. So here's Jonathan, who's Assistant Professor of Mathematics at Austin State University. He says, I've been listening to Unbelievable about 6 months. Thanks for providing opportunity for wonderful discussion and debate. Just finished listening to the second part of the McGrew and Ehrman debate. Bart made the point that the Gospels progressively and chronologically become more antagonistic towards the Jewish leaders in their recounting of the questioning of Jesus by Pilate. The least antagonistic recounting was Mark's Gospel, since it was earliest. However, a cursory look through the book of Mark demonstrates that his recounting included many references that cast responsibility or implied responsibility onto the elders and chief priests. And then you give a long list of some of the examples from the passion narrative in Mark. Perhaps I missed Bart's point, but by no means does the book of Mark let the chief priests and elders off the hook for hating, conspiring and crucifying Jesus. In my view, the other Gospels aren't much different in describing how the elders and chief priests comprised the contingent who were tangibly responsible for his death. Theologically, I believe I crucified Jesus because of my sin and rebellion, so I'm in no place to condemn the Jewish leaders of the time. We all need his mercy and his righteousness. Appreciate the show. Plan on listening for years to come. Thanks. Thank you, Jonathan. Hope we're here in years to come. Justin, firstly, love the podcast. Wonderful conversations. This is from Chris Templeton. Been thinking back through your Summer of Scripture and have really been finding quite a challenge in it. I find the argument from the person of Christ is rare in debate, yet is the strongest one Christianity has. Odd to me, but Arden actually did argue it last week and Atkins seemed completely stumped as to how one could even understand it. It seems that the question rests entirely on the resurrection and reduces to an acceptance of supernatural or an acceptance of the immutability of the order as described in science. What I didn't hear this summer was why the historical scholars believe as they do. After acknowledging some permutation of the minimal facts, what brings Crossley, Ehrman, etc. to not believe? And then on the flip side, if these facts aren't necessarily enough, what else do McGrew, Habermas, etc. bring to the discussion that convinces them? I'd love it if you knew where I could find this information and could pass it on to me. Some sort of blog or another show, perhaps. Perhaps I just need to buy a bunch of their books. You also discovered that you share an undergrad alma mater with Ehrman. There you go. Thank you very much, Chris. Yes, if you go back, if you continue your journey through the podcast, you will find some personal explanations from some of the skeptical Bible scholars we've interviewed over the years as to why they lost their faith or didn't have a faith or whatever it might be, why they don't believe. Inevitably, I think, you know, believing in that Jesus was the Son of God and rose from the dead does something which requires going as like is maybe supported by the historical evidence. You can make a claim for that, but obviously involves a step beyond that, which is putting your trust into a person, a historical person, and in a sense, a supernatural person. So I can understand why many historical scholars, you know, won't make that step, if you like. They don't feel obliged to do that from just the historical record. But I know that for many, it has been the historical record that has been part of the journey in making that step of faith in the end. But thanks for getting in touch. And Taylor says, thanks for another couple of great episodes. I feel the need to point out, though, that Gary Habermas's collected minimal facts are somewhat misleading. His study that has been used to support these so-called facts has not been conducted under any statistical analytic method, and he's not released his data despite requests from skeptics, making it fairly dubious if any of the trends he mentions are actually representative of biblical scholarship on the whole. Likewise, he openly admitted on the show that the minimal facts are essentially minimally important. The background philosophical assumptions about miracles, the identity of Jesus, etc., are what actually do all the work in supporting the resurrection. So on the question of whether the minimal facts support the resurrection, it seems the answer is more accurately no, not unless you add on these significant assumptions which few skeptics would be willing to grant, says Taylor. And Thomas, finally on this, says, a quick observation of the second Ehrman versus McGrew debate. I wish Tim had spent more time laying out the foundation of probability theory that undergirds his arguments from undesigned coincidences. He is, after all, a noted expert in the field of epistemology, particularly in Bayes' probability theory. When Ehrman heard the word coincidence, he immediately thought that McGrew was essentially pulling attention by stretching the four Gospels together in an effort to force them to fit together. But given McGrew's expertise in probability, I have a feeling the argument had much more force than that. For example, the odds of the boat in the ocean during the Battle of Midway being described by both sides would be extraordinarily unlikely had neither account actually have had any eyewitnesses linked to the event. Maybe this could have helped Ehrman and McGrew understand each other more easily and make much of the untoward vitriol that came out during the discussion wholly unnecessary. In contrast, James Crossley and Gary Habermas did a great job of actually engaging each other's points during the discussion. There you go. Time, oh, well, time is running out, but let's try and fit in a couple at least of your messages in response to that Zachary Arden and Peter Atkins show that I mentioned earlier. And again, that was a very interesting interaction, wasn't it? Here's David Robertson, no stranger to the show, emailing in to say it was an astonishing show, not least because Atkins was supposed to provide the scientific case for non-belief in God and gave almost no scientific evidence for his claims. Instead, he resorted to amateur psychology, name-calling, and an ignorant childish philosophy. His constant retort to anything that he disagreed was, "That's lazy," although he showed himself his own laziness and inability by refusing to engage with anything he disagreed with. And here's Carrie, who takes issue with Zachary, feels he could have taken Peter Atkins more to task. It isn't that they're not good arguments. The thing is, these atheists have all heard it all before, says Carrie Brown. Ontological this, teleological that. It's water off the duck's back. And Zachary, no disrespect, but you were easy meat. Smarten up, interrupt, like Peter Atkins constantly did. Fire back, ad lib, and play them at their own game. Rip their argument apart. I mean, there's plenty to have a go at. You're a biologist, so take evolution for starters. Forget God of the gaps. How about evolution of the gaps? And what about the Peter Atkins challenge that belief in God is lazy? That it's a science stopper? That old chestnut? Boring. Come on, Zachary, remind him you're in the lab working your socks off, not touring around the world on the celebrity atheist bandwagon, and it hasn't stopped your science, and neither will it, presumably. Though I have to say at this point, shock horror, if for whatever unfortunate reason science did come to a full stop, so what? The world doesn't owe scientists a living any more than it does artists, cleaners, or beekeepers. Anyway, Carrie carries on in like manner. I personally thought Zachary did a great job, though, and many people also feel that he did. Here's Paul McCauley in Belfast, says, "I thought Zachary did a wonderful job, but Peter showed himself to be utterly insincere in his search for truth. His questions about God being a jelly and him hammering molecules together showed an embarrassing immaturity, and his comments on the Gospels displayed inexcusable ignorance. While Zachary, on the other hand, comported himself with class and dignity and showed himself to be on top of all the issues." And Tim in Kobe, Japan says, "Thanks for another excellent show. I think Zachary did very well in making a positive case while rebutting Peter Atkins' points. But there's one point I wish he could have pursued with respect to naturalism. There needs to be a distinction made between two forms of naturalism, that of methodological naturalism versus philosophical naturalism. This distinction goes hand in hand with another important one that's often overlooked, and that is that there are two distinct types of science. I refer to them as empirical science and historical science. Unless both of those distinctions are made, I think the dialogue gets muddled and little progress gets made." Anyway, thank you very much for all of the responses, and sorry, haven't had time to read all of those emails out, or indeed many of the others that we've had. But we'll get some more of them in next week, and some of your responses to today's show and last week when Andy Bannister interacted with Ed Turner on whether atheism is a belief system. Had some interesting interactions on Twitter on that one as well. But for the moment, thank you very much for joining me, and I hope you can join me through the coming autumn as well. Lots more great shows coming up. Let me tell you what's coming next week. You're unbelievable. Well, today in China, the Christian church is growing. There are reputed to be up to 100 million Christians in China, and by 2030, it may well overtake the US in terms of weekly churchgoers. But at the same time, the Chinese government is reported to be cracking down in some areas on religious movements. Well, we're going to be asking what the future of China is next week. John Lombard is an ex-Christian who actually moved out to China to plant churches but lost his faith. He's going to be debating with David Marshall, who's a Christian working out in China, and they're going to be asking, should China's future be secular humanism or a Christian framework? So look out for that coming into your podcast and on your radio sets next week at the same time here on Unbelievable. For the moment, thanks for being with me, and The Profile is next.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings. Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.